Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Oh, such a clutch pickup, Dave.
I know, right? I was worried we'd bring back the same team.
Oh, no, I meant those blackout motorized shades. MVP of the room.
Blinds.com made it crazy affordable to replace our old blinds.
Hard to install?
No, it's easy. Even you could do it.
Nice.
I installed these and then got some for my mom, too.
What, you fly across the country to do the install?
Nope. Blinds.com can do it all. All she had to do was pick what she wanted. She talked to a design consultant for free and scheduled a professional measure and install.
Look at you, Hall of Fame son.
Oh, I just picked the winning team. They're the number one online retailer of custom window coverings in the world.
Oh, Blinds.com is the GOAT.
The GOAT.
He shoots. He scores.
Go to Blinds.com for up to 45% off and a 100% satisfaction guarantee. Go right now for up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
This is a Radio.com original.
This is Coronavirus Daily. I'm Mike Simpson.
And I'm Charles Feldman.
We are here every day to bring you the very latest up-to-date information, help guide you and your family through this coronavirus pandemic. Coming up.
Well, President Trump finally did it. He declared a national emergency. A lot of people wanted him to do that for quite some time, right? But now he has done it. The question, will this help? Well, we will hear from a former Obama administration official who led the response to the Ebola outbreak.
We'll also talk with a woman who suffered through the virus, what she thought at first. She's doing okay now. She'll tell us what it was all like.
I don't know how many people out there may have heard Congresswoman Katie Porter. You heard her the other day?
She got out her whiteboard.
Oh, yeah. She slammed the head of the CDC at a committee hearing. We will hear from the Congresswoman about why she was so upset and what she hoped to accomplish.
And scientists, they're working around the clock. They want to learn more about the virus because there's still plenty of questions that they don't have answers to. There's one doctor who led a team that developed a new test, and they did this in just a matter of weeks.
Let's begin with the National Emergency Declaration. Jeremy Kuhnendijk is a senior policy fellow at the Center for Global Development. He served as director of USAID's Office of U.S. Foreign Disaster Assistance. That was in the Obama administration, where he led the response to the Ebola outbreak. Jeremy, welcome. Is this a welcome development, and what does it mean?
It is a positive development. I think it does give the states more flexibility to use a toolkit that looks more like what we're accustomed to seeing after an earthquake or a hurricane or something like that. So that is good. I think we need to have all tools on the table. The frustrating thing is that a lot of the measures that the president announced at this press conference just now could have been triggered 2 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, and then we would have been in a much better position at this point.
It seems like some of them have already been. I mean, he says open up emergency operation centers. A lot of states have, or at least the local county governments. LA's is up and running, the sheriff's department, and hospitals activate your emergency plans, which are in place. So I feel like there's also a sense that maybe the locals have been handling this already, and now Washington's kind of catching up.
I think that's absolutely right. The locals have been forced into doing some of these things by facts on the ground. It would have been far better if they'd been able to anticipate and prepare. And look, it's been obvious since we saw what happened in China in mid-January that this was a risk. So we could have been much better prepared for it than we are. I'm glad to see some of these moves today, but we're in catch-up mode.
You know, of course, a lot is being made about testing, the lack of testing. And is there a point, and are we near that point, maybe we are at that point, when the testing becomes superfluous because containment has clearly not happened? It's all over the United States, the virus. There's no accepted treatment at the moment for it. So knowing the results one way or the other than for the fact of having the data available, which may be significant, isn't really going to make a difference to the patient. So are we making too much about the availability of testing?
No, I don't think we are. The two countries that have seen really large-scale spread and then been able to curtail that, which is China and South Korea, have both done that on the back of wide-scale testing. you know, testing is important so that you know your status. You know, we used to say in the HIV world, public health HIV world, that you wanted to know your status because if someone knows their HIV status, they know if they can spread it. Well, this is similar. You want to know your status. You want to know if you're posing a risk to others, and then you adjust your behavior accordingly. Right now, people can't do that. So they don't know if they have a cold or if they have coronavirus, and that's very dangerous.
Take me through the testing as you understand it. Maybe we should have been at this point where it's more widespread, or at least that's the promise a month ago. But
yeah.
We have our governor talking and saying, look, there's different parts to this test. I don't have all the parts in all the places, so I'm moving them.
Yeah.
Is it more complicated than we think?
Yeah. I think we have made it more complicated than we need to. And if you look at what they've done in China and North Korea, China and South Korea, it's been a much more straightforward test. They kind of started simple and built towards something more sophisticated. Here, we tried to start very sophisticated from the beginning with the CDC test that kind of was a lot fancier than what the World Health Organization was putting out, and then it didn't work. Start simple, build from there is generally a better way to approach these things, and I think that's a lesson we should have applied.
During the Ebola outbreak, when you were involved in government there, in the government response, how was it different than the response to this?
Well, it was very different because this is a much greater threat. This is a much greater threat domestically. You know, the Ebola is a very dangerous disease if you get it, but it's quite hard. It's quite difficult to get. And so despite all the panic in this country, the level of actual risk was not as great as people imagined. I think here, so there we overestimated the domestic risk. Here, the public has underestimated the risk, and I think now the perceptions are catching up to the reality.
And your response to the president when he lashes out at the former administration, your former administration, saying that there were failures there?
He doesn't know what he's talking about. I mean, look, he is out of his depth. He has made a number of mistakes, and you know what he does in that sort of a situation is try to deflect responsibility, and I think that's what he's doing. He needs to take responsibility for this. It's 3 years into his administration. He owns this. He needs to get on top of it.
Jeremy Kneindike, Senior Policy Fellow, Center for Global Development, served as Director of USAID's Office of U.S. Foreign Disaster Assistance in the Obama administration, where he led the response to the Ebola outbreak. Jeremy, thanks for the time.
You're listening to Coronavirus Daily, along with Mike Simpson. I'm Charles Feldman.
So what is it like to actually be infected with this virus, suffer through it, and then come out the other end? We're going to talk with Elizabeth Schneider now, a bioengineering manager in Seattle. She tested positive for COVID-19, has spent the last several weeks in quarantine. So Elizabeth, how are you feeling now?
Fortunately, I'm not in self-quarantine anymore, thankfully. I did get word that a test that I submitted on Saturday Sunday, March 1st, had tested positive, but I got the call this past Saturday, March 7th, and by then it had already, I had already exceeded the time deadlines for self-isolation that are the guidelines for our local King County Public Health. And I was actually already recovered and feeling better and didn't have any more symptoms and did not have a fever. But, you know, other than that, I'm doing quite well. I'm feeling better. I'm feeling normal. I have my energy back. I am, you know, going out to do errands and grocery shopping here and there, but I'm not doing anything major. And the first 2 days after I recovered, I did feel a little bit tired, similar to how you feel when you get over a normal cold or the flu.
Take us back to the beginning of it. What were the first symptoms you experienced, and when was that?
So I first experienced symptoms over 2 weeks ago. It was a Tuesday. It was the 25th of February. I woke up in the morning. I felt tired, a little groggy. I didn't think too much of it. The previous weekend, I had been really busy. I had been going out and doing a lot of activities with friends. So I thought that I had just perhaps overexerted myself and that I needed to take it easy and stay in that night and go to bed early. I went to work like normal, and then in midday, I started getting a general sense that I was unwell. I had a headache. I had some body aches. I felt a little bit feverish. I was tired. I decided that I needed to go home around midday. I went home. I worked from home the rest of the day. I took an early nap. When I woke up from my nap, I had 101 degree temperature, and by the time I had finished eating dinner and was getting ready to go to bed, my temperature had spiked to 103 degrees. So at that point, I definitely knew that I was sick.
Did it feel different to you than other illnesses I presume you've had throughout your life? Maybe you've had the flu before or a bad cold. Was there something about this that made you think, this is different?
Yeah, that's a great question. And to be honest, the answer is no. I didn't really feel anything different. You know, I felt a general feeling of malaise, that kind of foggy-headed feeling you get when you have a cold and you just think you're not really thinking straight. You know, I had a fever, I had the chills, I had the sweats, I, you know, had body aches, I had a headache, I was tired. After a few days, my fever temperature got down to 101. You know, I was taking over-the-counter medications and getting a lot of rest and drinking water. I did have nausea one day, but I think the one salient point that I want to make, and the reason why I did not think that I had the coronavirus initially, is that I had zero respiratory symptoms. I did not have a cough. I didn't have any tightness in my chest. I didn't have any shortness of breath. And at that time, everything circulating in the media said that, well, these were some of the hallmark features of the infection, and that, you know, yeah, you will get like body aches, you'll get a fever, you'll feel tired, all of those things. But it said, yeah, you have a cough, a dry cough, persistent dry cough, respiratory symptoms that will progress into pneumonia, and I didn't have any of those symptoms.
Wow. Okay. So you didn't think you had it at first because you didn't have the usual suspect symptoms. And yeah, when you were listing through all of what you had, I was waiting for coughing. I was waiting for shortness of breath, and then it just never came.
Correct. Yeah.
Were you, and I know your educational background is such that you probably know a lot more about these things than the average person does. Nonetheless, when you started thinking that, you know, maybe this is the coronavirus infection, did you get frightened?
So I wasn't too frightened, I think, because I was feeling better and I was recovering. And I just followed all of the old adages that you do when you're sick. You know, like I said, I took over-the-counter medication. I took ibuprofen. I took extra strength Excedrin. I took some Sudafed. I had some congestion. I took vitamins. I drank a lot of water. I slept a ton. I binge-watched a lot of Netflix shows.
Today's 2020 treatment. Yeah, Netflix.
Yeah, I ordered a lot of takeout, a lot of Uber Eats deliveries. So I wasn't really that scared.
But let me ask you something that I think maybe many people are curious about. Once you found out through the test that you were positive for the virus that causes COVID-19 and you had it, did it in any way change your treatment? Because it sounds like you were self-treating with all the stuff that most people self-treat for when they've got a cold or even the flu. Did anything different happen in terms of your medical treatment?
No, really not. So by that time, this past Saturday on March 7th, when I got word that I had tested positive, like I said, I was pretty much recovered. I didn't have a fever anymore. I did feel a little tired, as I mentioned earlier. You know, so I had most of my major symptoms were gone. So nothing really changed. The only thing I would say is that I did call my doctor this past Monday just to give them a heads up of what had happened. And I was a little shocked, actually, when I got the phone call, because, like I said, I didn't really think that I had it. But one interesting detail of my story is that I did sort of get an inkling or suspect that maybe there was something else going on, because apart from me getting sick on that Tuesday, about a dozen other people in my friend circle got sick, and we had all attended the same house party.
Wow.
3 days before. And we came to know that we were all sick through one of the people in the friend circle posting on Facebook, and then we all commented and said, oh my gosh, I'm sick too. Oh, when did you get sick? Oh, I got sick Tuesday evening. And so we kind of all wondered what was going on. And interestingly, some of those friends actually did go to their doctors. The doctors suspected that they had the flu, tested them, it came back negative. They were essentially sent home. They weren't tested for coronavirus, and many of them didn't have a cough or any of those respiratory symptoms. Similar to myself.
Yeah, but that's a guy the wheels turning, the whole dinner party at the same time. Okay, wow. Elizabeth Schneider, bioengineering manager in Seattle, did test positive for COVID-19. Doing better now. Elizabeth, we are glad that you are feeling well again. This is Coronavirus Daily, along with Charles Feldman. I'm Mike Simpson.
Orange County Congresswoman Katie Porter, well, she just slammed the head of the CDC when he appeared in front of her congressional committee. She pulled no punches. She got him to commit to using CDC authority to cover all costs of a coronavirus test.
You might have seen the clip. It is all over the internet. Katie Porter is with us now. Congresswoman, your analysis of how the federal government is doing, how they've responded to this outbreak so far.
So we have been too slow in ramping up the production of tests and in distributing those tests. We also need to begin to activate additional resources that could be used for testing. And so, for example, yesterday I led a letter talking about how we could put testing machines that are currently used within the University of California system for research, how we could safely and in compliance with health guidance be able to use those machines to conduct additional flu tests so that we're expanding our capacity beyond the existing clinical system to use some of those research machines. There's the additional issue about who's going to pay for the testing, which, as I spoke about yesterday when I questioned the director of the CDC, that test can be expensive, particularly coming into the ER and having to go through that testing process can overwhelm people. We want to make sure that anyone who is symptomatic is able to afford to get tested regardless of insurance.
Well, when we say we want to make sure, is this going to require what? Is it going to require legislation? Is it going to just require that companies, insurance companies, agree to it? What's the mechanism to make sure this happens?
There is an existing law that was finalized a couple years ago that will permit the Centers for Disease Control director, who works under Secretary of Health and Human Services, Azar, to provide that the federal government will pay, subject to insurers paying first if the person has insurance, for medical examination, including diagnostic testing. So this is already in the law. The folks in our government thought about this, put this rule in place for exactly the circumstance, which is why I pressed the CDC director so hard for why he's not using the existing tools that we could be already using. We don't need an act of Congress to provide for free testing. We simply need to hold the CDC director and this administration accountable to use the law that thoughtful people put in place in years past.
So are we going to? Is the CDC going to?
We absolutely will be holding the CDC to account for this. He was sworn in under oath when he testified before Congress, and the American people need to be able to trust that when witnesses speak to the American public under oath, that they are giving their word, and that we in Congress will hold them to account, and that's exactly what I'm going to do.
And he presumably said that yes, the CDC will invoke this law.
It took some tough questioning and several tries at it, but he did commit that the CDC will cover the cost of testing, including for those who do not have insurance.
Okay. Now, let me move on to a different thing, because I don't know if you've been to a supermarket in the past 24 hours. I've gone to a couple. And at least here in Los Angeles, and I know from people I've talked to, certainly in New York and probably in many other parts of the country, it's become almost a panicked situation. People are stocking up as if the end of the world is about to fall on them. Are we at a point, as this country has done in the past for various emergencies, certainly during times of war like World War II, do we need rationing of things like food supplies, medical supplies?
So right now, I encourage people to purchase things that they need, plan for an additional week or so. Most stores are having most things in stock at the start of the day. It's typically at the end of the day before they reinvigorate their supply. But everybody should make sure that they have enough supplies so that they're not going, and the biggest reason for this is so that they're not going out to the store every day. So the concept here is to minimize the amount of exposure and contact that we have to each other. So people shouldn't be hoarding months of supplies of things. Instead, what they should be doing is trying, instead of, if they used to go to the grocery store every other day, they should try to buy a week's worth, so that they're not having as much contact. But right now, any of the shortages are mostly toward the end of the day, and they're shorter. The other thing I want to emphasize to people is that hand soap is 100% effective, and it's about the rubbing and the thorough hand washing. If you can't find hand soap, another good alternative is dishwasher soap, like Dawn. something like that can also be used that has enough soap in it to disinfect your hands.
Yeah, but you know, one of the other recommendations that we always hear about with this is, you know, if you don't have soap and you're in a situation where you don't have access to even water, use hand sanitizer, but good luck finding it. And I'm puzzled why in this country we can't manage to manufacture, it's a simple product, why we can't just go into hyperdrive to manufacture enough hand sanitizer for people to get.
No, absolutely. We are going to need to ramp that up. The other thing we have to make sure we're doing is that the hand sanitizer in particular needs to be delivered first and foremost to our frontline medical providers, to EMTs, to firefighters, to nurses, to receptionists, to areas, to people who are out doing public health work. Most of us are able to get to running water and to use a traditional bar of soap. So as a mother of a teenage boy, I have purchased a lot of soap over the years. Some of it hasn't gone used. I'm going to put that to work and make sure that everyone in my household, when I get back to California, is doing a thorough job washing their hands. I'm sitting here in D.C. still hoping to vote for a package today, hopefully, that will help address some of these issues. But people don't need to panic. The whole goal of stocking up isn't that we anticipate shortages so much as we're trying to reduce the number of times people go to the store and have contact with each other.
Orange County Congresswoman Katie Porter.
You're listening to Coronavirus Daily along with Mike Simpson. I'm Charles Feldman.
Scientists around the country, around the world, they have been working pretty furiously, studying the virus, developing their own tests for it.
Researchers at the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota created a coronavirus test in only 3 weeks. WCCO's Jordana Green talked with Dr. Matthew Binneker, who is a clinical microbiologist at the Mayo Clinic. He explains what the test is and how people can get it.
Typically, when we bring up a test for an infectious disease like influenza or something else, it may take us 6 months or even up to 12 months to do that. So to be able to go from start to finish in 3 weeks, again, just speaks to the heroic effort of the team here at Mayo. So this test is similar to the one that the Centers for Disease Control and the state health labs are running. It is a test that picks up the virus's RNA, so that's part of the genome of the virus, in samples that are collected from a patient's nose or lung. So it's not a blood test. The physician's actually taking a swab, putting it in the nose, and then sending that swab to the lab, and we try to determine whether the virus's genome is in that sample. We're able to get results back to the physician same day, so it takes about 4 to 6 hours for the laboratory to actually perform the test. Now, that doesn't factor in transport to the laboratory, but we're hoping to get results back to our physicians within 24 hours.
I understand the test has been fully validated and the data will be submitted to the FDA. So the test, is it available nationwide now?
Currently, because of our capacity for reagents and equipment, we're going to be performing the testing this week for patients in the Southeast Minnesota area, part of the Mayo Clinic Health System. We have equipment on the way and reagents, test reagents on the way, because we know that there is a significant need both within Minnesota and across the country to help out with the Centers for Disease Control and state health labs. So we are doing everything we can to get our testing capacity as high as we can to help alleviate the burden of the CDC and the state health labs.
Do you know anything about if this test will be free to patients who need it?
I can't comment specifically about cost, but I have been in some discussions with those that are involved in pricing of tests. And the theme there has been we have to make this test as affordable as possible, because as many patients who have symptoms and the disease need to have the test performed. So I know there is a lot of efforts going on to make, again, the cost of testing as low as possible. The government's really stepping up here as well and trying to figure out how to get the test performed for those who need it.
I understand that Mayo has begun a pre-screen drive-through process to test people. Is that currently underway in Rochester now?
Correct. On our northwest side of town, we have a drive-through collection center. It's at an outpatient clinic. And that really is designed to prevent patients who are sick from having to come inside to a clinic and be around other patients. So they still have to call in, talk to a nurse or a physician, describe their clinical symptoms. So again, that we're going to be testing the right people and not just everyone who's worried about having been exposed. And then if they get that screen and an order for the test to be performed, they will come to that clinic. A provider will actually perform the collection, and then the patient will drive away. So that's another mechanism of what we're calling social distancing. We don't want people who are sick to be going into areas with other healthy individuals.
So they get to stay in their car and get a swab?
Exactly.
Now that you have this test, are you working on any treatments or a vaccine?
So the treatment and vaccine is being handled by colleagues in other areas. My focus is the test, but I do know from discussions both within Mayo Clinic and around the country, there's a lot of activity going on in terms of developing therapeutics and vaccines, but that's going to take some time.
Dr. Matthew Binneker, clinical microbiologist and director of the Clinical Virology Laboratory at Mayo Clinic.
We will be back tomorrow. Download Coronavirus Daily. Visit our radio.com website, radio.com/coronavirus, for the very latest up-to-the-minute information on this pandemic and how to keep yourself and those around you safe and healthy.